Week in and week out, my preaching not only tries to connect a biblical text with what I see going on among us and in our world, but it also relates to my own struggles with what it means to follow Jesus in this particular time and place. Now, grace lets us off the hook for missing the impossible goal of perfection. No matter how hard we try, we do not hit the mark. But sometimes I admit we can be too hard on ourselves and others, perhaps expecting too much. On the other hand, there is that constant need to allow the Spirit of God to knock scales from our eyes, to convict us of our self-centeredness and unloving ways, and to help us align our professed faith with our actual attitudes and actions. One of the most challenging aspects of living faithfully is to live in healthy relationships with each other, especially those with whom we might have strong disagreements, broken trust, or ill feelings. Fractured relationships are not easy to mend and sometimes impossible. Communities of all types, but especially faith communities, depend on forgiveness, given and accepted, on repaired relationships, and a willingness for a hurt person to take the first step on the high road of reconciliation. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus offers an approach to bring healing to fractured relationships. It's an approach that deserves our attention, but also some caution. Hear these words from Matthew 18, beginning in verse 15. If your brother sins against you, go to him. Tell him what he did wrong. Keep it between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won him back. But what if he won't listen to you? Then take one or two others with you. Scripture says, and he quotes from Deuteronomy, every matter must be proved by the words of two or three witnesses. But what if he also refuses to listen to the witnesses? Then tell it to the church. And what if he refuses to listen even to the church? Then don't treat him as your brother. Treat him as you would an ungodly person or a tax collector. What I'm about to tell you is true. What you lock on earth will be locked in heaven. What you unlock on earth will be unlocked in heaven. Again, here's what I tell you. Suppose two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, my Father in heaven will do it for you. Where two or three might meet together in my name, I am there with them. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. These are some challenging words of Jesus, both in seeking to understand them and to apply them. But first, let's confess that reconciliation is not our default setting when someone hurts us. When we feel hurt or disappointed or misled or lied to, our default is to get even. So our natural response is to find ways, obvious and subtle, to bring harm of some kind to the one who offended us. And there are plenty of available weapons. We badmouth the person privately or publicly. We undermine their closest relationships, or worse. Now, there's plenty of room to debate many aspects of Jesus' teaching here, but one thing is very clear. Jesus is placing the responsibility for initiating the process of reconciliation in the hands of the one who feels offended. Now that's just like Jesus, isn't it? Always turning things around from the way we want them to be. So according to Jesus, the offended one is not to wait for the one who carries more of the blame to ask for forgiveness. Reconciliation is too important for waiting. Now, my Bible scholar friend Tony Cartledge makes an interesting observation about Matthew's gospel in general. While it was not the first gospel written, that was Mark, it was placed first in the canon of scriptures that we call the New Testament. Perhaps Tony suggested that's because Matthew wrote more specifically to a Jewish audience and Jesus came first to the Jews. Or perhaps it's because Matthew's gospel was the one most commonly used among early believers. We simply don't know for sure. However, we do know that Matthew always showed concern for the community of faith. In fact, Tony notes that Matthew is the only gospel that uses the word ecclesia that is translated in the New Testament as church. Now, it's not surprising the word ecclesia doesn't appear in the other gospels since the church did not exist during Jesus' time on earth. But it does suggest that Matthew must have seen something of how Jesus' life and ministry would lead believers to come together in communities of faith, of worship, and of service as followers of Jesus together. Therefore, Jesus' approach to conflict resolution is very helpful instruction. It shifts the focus from the fracture to the possibility of healing. Now, Jesus' four-step approach is connected by a series of ifs. If one doesn't work, you move on to the next step. But he calls first for an individual initiative. If you feel that someone has hurt you, go to that person in private and try to work things out. Clearly, Jesus' preference and hope is that two persons who claim to follow him will be able to work out their differences based on mutual respect and forgiveness, even if not full agreement. Should that fail, the offended person, if convinced that he or she is still hurt and needs to resolve this in a different way, then involves others, also privately and with hope of success. And if not, then take it before the larger community of faith. And should that fail, Jesus says something that sounds quite harsh. Then don't treat him as your brother, but treat him as an ungodly person or a tax collector. Of course, this raises the question of how Jesus wants us to treat those outside the circle of faith. And we need to be very careful not to impose our desires upon Jesus. Now, it would be helpful to know exactly what kind of conflict Jesus is addressing here, but that is not clear. All we know is that one member of the church has apparently offended another in some way. Now, there is a translation issue here as well. The oldest manuscripts of Matthew's gospel simply refer to the offense as sins. It's only later that was added the sins against you. So we do not know if this was a personal offense against someone or something that was causing destruction in the larger community. Now, this is one of those places in Scripture where we need to raise a huge caution flag. It is too easy for us to make Jesus' teaching here into justification for pointing out everything we consider to be sinful in another person. I am reminded of a young woman in my college days who thought it was her divine responsibility to straighten out everyone else's lives. She always had a word of rebuke for another student. I recall a friend telling me of hearing a knock on her dorm room door. She opened to find this dorm mate who did not greet her but raised her large Bible, read a rather obscure passage of Scripture loudly, then closed her Bible and said, I was having my quiet time, and when I read that verse, I felt God was telling me to tell you, you wear too much makeup. I really don't think that's what Jesus has in mind here. This teaching needs to be balanced with Jesus' words back in chapter 7 of Matthew. First, take the piece of wood out of your own eye. Then you will be able to see clearly to take the bit of sawdust out of your friend's eye. In this teaching, confrontation and condemnation are not the goal. Reconciliation is the goal. Healing within the community of faith. It's not about straightening someone else out so they will do things like we want them to do. So often our self-righteousness, something Jesus warned about so often, can get masked as concern. But we must approach such a situation with humility and love and genuine concern for that other person and for the community at large. Here Jesus uses a word translated as sin to suggest that this offense is not a minor one to be brushed aside, but it's something that needs careful, faithful attention. Since Jesus was so hard on the Pharisees who demanded everyone to align with their narrow beliefs and behavior, it's unlikely that Jesus was pointing to some issue of insignificance or legalism. Likely some issue, some problem, was threatening the unity of believers and needed attention. You know, so often churches and families and friendships get broken over fixable matters that simply never receive a constructive response. That's what Jesus calls us to initiate. However, Jesus is not naive. There are those who do not want solutions if it requires any give on their part. Reconciliation requires mutual respect, mutual forgiveness, and mutual care. And those who remain unwilling to participate do not have a rightful place in the fellowship. At least that's how I read Jesus' words here. I've always thought the word de-escalation was strange, but it's a word that is used often in conflict resolution. It means that we as peacemakers and reconcilers should take steps to calm down a situation in order to create an environment in which reconciliation and resolution can take place. That's important in a community of faith. For the opposite is to act in ways that cause additional hurt and the greater possibility for the harm of more people. You ever notice that healing doesn't work when we sulk, trade insults, badmouth those with whom we have disagreements? No reconciliation take someone being Jesus enough to take the first good step, and if that doesn't work, to take the next one. See, unity is about more than getting my way. It is about bringing together those of a shared faith in order to fulfill God's good purpose on earth. We can only do that when we acknowledge that we are all unreconciled people. See, that's what the gospel is all about, being reconciled to God through the forgiveness of sins provided to us in Jesus Christ. We are reconciled with God not because we're right, not because we're good, not because we have the most convincing arguments. It is through the grace of Jesus Christ, despite our failings. And if God desires to be reconciled with us, then shouldn't we seek to to be reconciled with others as much as possible. Even if we're the one who feels hurt and need to take the first step. Two good questions keep lingering in my mind. Do you need to be reconciled with God? If so, Jesus provides the way. And do you need to be reconciled with someone else? If so, Jesus offers a good way to do that if we're up to it. There is no place where reconciliation is more clear than at this table. Here we witness and experience the reality that God has taken the initiative, the first step, in making right that which is wrong in our lives. That's why we gather at this table again and again. My pastor friend Jim Dant was in the Holy Land a few years ago. And while in Bethlehem, he found a craftsman making small communion cups out of olive wood. And he said, "That's really cool. I think I will get enough of those to use at the Christmas Eve communion service and let people take them home." So he approached the craftsman and said, "How long would it take and what would it cost to get about 250 of those?" The man looked surprised, and they finally worked out a deal. And a few days later, he had those cups, and he stuffed them in every void of his luggage. He got them home, and he had them proudly ready, and we gathered for communion on that night. And Jim explained where the cups had come from, and how he wanted us to take communion in them, and how we would take them home to remind us of that night. Soon the cups had been distributed and we were getting ready to take communion. As Jim was giving the words of institution, grape juice was leaking through every single cup. It was all over us and all over everything in the church. What a beautiful lesson. Because we, like those cups, are imperfect. We all leak. It is through the gift of Jesus Christ, not our own goodness, that we gather at this table, our leaky selves, so that we can be reconciled with God, who calls us to be reconciled with one another. May we, leaky people, share this holy meal together.